Evidently, it suits our purposes, the deputy DDO informed them. Basil says the operation is nominal to this point. No surveillance on our subjects has been spotted. Everything looks entirely routine. I guess our cousins have a competent station chief in Budapest. The three bodies arrived there today. Just a matter of crossing the T's and dotting the I's. Confidence level? The DDI asked. Oh, say 75%, Admiral, Bostock estimated. Maybe better. What about Ryan? Greer asked next. No beefs from London on how he's doing. I guess your boy's handling himself. He's a good kid. He ought to. I wonder how unhappy he is, Judge Moore wondered. The other two each had a smile and a head shake at that. Bostock spoke first. Like all DO people, he had his doubts about members of the far more numerous DI. Probably not as comfortable as he is at his desk with his comfy swivel chair. He'll do fine, gentlemen, Greer assured them, hoping he was right. I wonder what this fellow has for us, Moore breathed. We'll know in a week, Bostock assured them. He was always the optimist. And 3 out of 4 constituted betting odds, so long as your own ass wasn't on the line. Judge Moore looked at his desk clock and added 6 hours. People would be asleep in Budapest now, and almost there in London. He remembered his own adventures in the field, mostly composed of waiting for people to show up for meets or filling out contact reports for the at-home bureaucrats who still ran things at CIA. You just couldn't get free of the fact that the agency was a government operation, subject to all of the same restrictions and inefficiencies that attended that sad reality. But this time, for this Beatrix operation, they were making things happen speedily for once. Only because this rabbit person said that government communications were compromised. Not because he'd said he had information about an innocent life that might be lost. The government had its priorities, and they did not always correspond to the needs of a rational world. He was director of Central Intelligence, supposedly, and by federal law, in command of the entire intelligence gathering and analysis operations of the government of the United States of America. But getting this bureaucracy to operate efficiently was the functional equivalent of beaching a whale and commanding it to fly. You could scream all you wanted, that you couldn't fight gravity. Government was a thing made by men, and so it ought to be possible for men to change it. But in practice, that just didn't happen. So 3 chances out of 4, they'd get their Russian out and get to debrief him in a comfortable safe house in the Virginia Hills, pick his brain clean, and maybe they'd find out some important and useful things. But the game wouldn't change, and neither, probably, would CIA. Anything we need to say to Basil? Nothing comes to mind, sir, Bostock answered. We just sit as still as we can and wait for his people to carry out the mission. Right, Judge Moore conceded. Despite the 3 pints of dark British beer, Ryan did not sleep well. He couldn't think of anything that he might be missing. Hudson and his crew seemed competent enough, and the rabbit family had looked ordinary enough on the street the previous morning. There were 3 people, one of whom really wanted out of the USSR, which struck Ryan as something entirely reasonable. Though the Russians were some of the most rabidly patriotic people in all the world. But every rule had exceptions, and evidently this man had a conscience and felt the need to stop something. Whatever it was, Jack didn't know, and he knew better than to guess. Speculation wasn't analysis, and good analysis was what they paid him his meager salary for. It would be interesting to find out. Ryan had never spoken directly with the defector. He'd read over their stuff and had sent written questions to some of them to get answers to specific inquiries, but he'd never actually looked one in the eye and watched his face when he answered. As in playing cards, it was the only way to read the other guy. He didn't have the ability at it that his wife had. There was something to be said for medical training, but neither was he a 3-year-old who'd believe anything. No. He wanted to see this guy, talk to him, and pick his brain apart, just to evaluate the reliability of what he said. The rabbit could be a plant, after all. KGB had done that in the past, Ryan had heard. There'd been one defector who'd come out after the assassination of John Kennedy, who'd proclaimed to the very heavens that KGB had taken no part in that act. It was, in fact, sufficient to make the agency wonder if maybe KGB had done precisely that. KGB could be tricky, but like all clever, tricky people, they inevitably overplayed their hand sooner or later. And the later they did it, the worse they overplayed it. They understood the West and how its people really thought things through. No, Ivan wasn't 10 feet tall, and neither was he a genius at everything, despite what the frightmongers in Washington, and even Summit Langley, thought. Everyone had the capacity for making mistakes. He'd learned that from his father, who'd made a living catching murderers, some of whom thought themselves very clever indeed. No, the only difference between a wise man and a fool was in the magnitude of his mistakes. To err was human, and the smarter and more powerful you were, the greater the scope of your screw-up. Like LBJ in Vietnam, the war Jack had barely avoided due to his age, a colossal screw-up foisted on the American people by the most adroit political tactician of his age, a man who'd thought his political abilities would translate to international power politics, only to learn that an Asian communist didn't think the same way that a senator from Texas did. All men had their limitations. It was just that some were more dangerous than others. And while genius knew it had limits, idiocy was always unbounded. He lay in his bed, smoking a cigarette and looking at the ceiling, wondering what would come tomorrow. Another manifestation of Sean Miller and his terrorists? Hopefully not, Jack thought, still wondering why Hudson wouldn't have a gun close by for the coming adventures. Had to be some European thing, he decided. Americans on hostile soil liked to have at least one friend around. Chapter 27 Rabbit Run. One more day in a strange city, Zaitsev thought, as the sun began to rise in the east, 2 hours earlier than in Moscow. At home he'd still be sleeping, Oleg Ivanich told himself. In due course, he hoped, he'd be waking up somewhere else, in an altogether different time zone yet again. But for now, he just lay still, savoring the moment. There was virtually no sound outside, perhaps a few delivery trucks on the streets. The sun was not quite yet above the horizon. It was dark, but no longer night. Brightening up, but not yet morning. The middle part of the early day. It could be a pleasant moment. It was a time children could like, a magical time when the world belonged only to those few who were awake, and all others were still unseen in their beds, and the kids could walk around like little kings, until their mothers caught them and dragged them back into their beds. But Zaitsev just lay there, hearing the slow breathing of his wife and daughter, while he was now fully awake, free to think entirely alone. When would they contact him? What would they say? Would they change their minds? Would they betray his trust? Why was he so goddamned uneasy about everything? Wasn't it time to trust the CIA just a little bit? Wasn't he going to be a huge asset to them? Would he not be valuable to them? Even KGB, as stingy as a child with the best toys, gave comfort and prestige to its defectors. All the alcohol Kim Philby could drink, all the zhopniki Burgess could ass fuck, or so the stories went. In both cases, the stories went, the appetites were fairly large. But such stories always grew with the telling, and they depended at least partly on the Soviet antipathy for homosexuals. He wasn't one of those. He was a man of principle, wasn't he? Zaitsev asked himself. Of course he was. For principle, he was taking his own life in his hands and juggling it, like knives in the circus. And like that juggler, only he would be hurt by a misjudgment. Oleg lit his first smoke of the day, trying to think things through for the 100th time, looking for another viable course of action. He could just go to the concerts, continue his shopping, take the train back to Kiev Station, and be a hero to his workmates for getting them their tape machines and pornographic movies, and the pantyhose for their wives, and probably a few things for himself. And KGB would never be the wiser. But then the Polish priest will die at Soviet hands. Hands, you have the power to forestall, and then what sort of man will you see in the mirror, Oleg Ivanovich? It always came back to the same thing, didn't it? But there was little point in going back to sleep. So he smoked his cigarette and lay there, watching the sky brighten outside his hotel window. Kathy Ryan didn't really wake up until her hand found empty bed where it ought to have found her husband. That automatically, somehow, caused her to come fully awake in an instant, and just as quickly to remember that he was out of town and out of the country. Theirs and this one, and that as a result, she was alone. Effectively a single mother, which was not something she'd bargained for when she'd married John Patrick Ryan, Sr. She wasn't the only woman in the world whose husband traveled on business. Her father did it often enough, and she'd grown up with that. But this was the first time for Jack, and she didn't like it at all. It wasn't that she was unable to cope. She had to cope on a daily basis with worse tribulations than this one. Nor was she concerned that Jack might be getting a little on the side while he was away. She had often enough wondered that about her father on his trips. Her parents' marriage had occasionally been a rocky one, and didn't know what her mother, now deceased, had wondered about. But with Jack, no, that ought not to be a problem. But she loved him, and she knew that he loved her, and people in love were supposed to be together. Had they met while he was still an officer in the Marine Corps, it would have been a problem with which she would have had to deal. And worse, she might someday have had to deal with a husband who'd gone in harm's way, and that, she was sure, was the purest form of hell to live with. But no, she'd not met him until after all that. Her own father had taken her to dinner, bringing Jack along as an afterthought. A bright young broker with keen instincts, ready to move from the Baltimore office up to New York, only to be surprised, pleasantly at first, by the interest they'd instantly found in each other. And then had come the revelation that Jack wanted to take his money and go back to teaching history, of all things. It was something she had to deal with more than Jack, who barely tolerated Joseph Mueller, senior vice president of Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith, plus whatever acquisitions they'd made in the past 5 years. Joe was still daddy to her, and him, which translated to that pain in the ass, to Jack. What the hell is he working on, she wondered. Bomb? Germany? NATO stuff? The goddamned intelligence business. Looking at secret stuff and making equally secret observations on it that went to other people who might or might not read it and think about it. She, at least, was in an honest line of work, making sick people well, or at least helping them to see better. But not Jack. It wasn't that he did useless things. He'd explained it to her earlier in the year. There were bad people out there, and somebody had to fight against them. Fortunately, he didn't do that with a loaded gun. Kathy hated guns, even the ones that had prevented her kidnapping and murder at their home in Maryland on the night that had ended blessedly with little Jack's birth. She'd treated her share of gunshot wounds in the emergency room during her internship, enough to see the harm they inflicted, though not the harm they might have prevented in other places. Her world was somewhat circumscribed in that respect. A fact she appreciated, which was why she allowed Jack to keep a few of the damn things close by, where the kids could not reach them, even standing on a chair. He'd once tried to teach her how to use them, but she'd refused even to touch the things. Part of her thought that she was overreacting, but she was a woman, and that was that. And Jack didn't seem to mind that very much. "But why isn't he here?" Kathy asked herself in the darkness. What could be so damned important as to take her husband away from his wife and children? He couldn't tell her, and that really made her angry. But there was no fighting it, and it wasn't as if she were dealing with a terminal cancer patient, and it wasn't as if he were boffing some German chippy on the side. But, damn, she just wanted her husband back. 800 miles away, Ryan was already awake, out of the shower, shaved, brushed, and ready to face the day. Something about travel made it easy for him to wake up in the morning. But now he had nothing to do until the embassy canteen opened. He looked at the phone by his bed and thought about calling home, but he didn't know how to dial out on this phone system, and he probably needed Hudson's permission and assistance to accomplish the mission. Damn. He'd awakened at 3 a.m, thinking to roll over and give Kathy a kiss on the cheek. It was something Jack liked to do, even though she never had any memory of it. The good news was that she always kissed back. She really did love him. Otherwise, the return kiss would not have come. People can't dissimulate while asleep. It was an important fact in Ryan's personal universe. There was no use turning on the bedside radio. Hungarian, actually Magyar, was a language probably found on the planet Mars. For damn sure it didn't belong on planet Earth. He'd not heard one, not even one word that he recognized from English, German, or Latin, the three languages he'd studied at one time or another in his life. The locals also spoke as quickly as a machine gun, adding to the difficulty on his part. Had Hudson dropped him off anywhere in this city, he would have been unable to find his way back to the British Embassy, and that was a feeling of vulnerability he hadn't had since he was 4 years old. He might as well have been on an alien planet, and having a diplomatic passport wouldn't help, since he was accredited by the wrong country to this alien world. Somehow he'd not fully considered that on the way in. Like most Americans, he figured that with a passport and an American Express card, he could safely travel the entire world in his shorts. But that world was only the capitalist world, where somebody would speak enough English to point him to a building with the American flag on the roof and U.S. Marines in the lobby. Not in this alien city. He didn't know enough to find the men's room. Well, he'd found one in a bar the previous day, Ryan admitted to himself. The feeling of helplessness was hovering at the border of his consciousness like the proverbial monster under the bed. But he was a grown-up American male citizen, over 30, formerly a commissioned officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. It wasn't the way he usually felt about things. And so he watched the numbers change on his digital clock radio, bringing him closer to his personal date with destiny. Whatever the hell that was going to be. One red-lit number at a time. Andy Hudson was already up and about. István Kovács was preparing for one of his normal smuggling runs, this time bringing Reebok running shoes into Budapest from Yugoslavia. His hard cash was in a steel box under his bed, and he was drinking his morning coffee and listening to music on the radio when a knock on the door made him look up. He walked to answer it in his underwear. "Andy," he said in surprise. "Did I wake you, István?" Kovács waved him inside. "No, I've been up for a half an hour. What brings you here?" "We need to move our package tonight," Hudson replied.
"When, exactly?"
"Oh, about 2 a.m. Hudson reached into his pocket and pulled out a wad of banknotes. "Here is half of the agreed sum." There was no point in paying this Hungarian what they were really worth.
It would alter the whole equation. Excellent. Can I get you some coffee, Andy?
Yes, thank you. Kovach waved him to the kitchen table and poured a cup.
How do you want to go about it?
I will drive our package to near the border, and you will take them across. I presume you know the border guards at the crossing point.
Yes, it will be Captain Budai Laszlo. I've done business with him for years. And Sergeant Kerekes Mihai. Good lad. Wants to go to university and be an engineer. They do 12-hour shifts at the crossing point, midnight to noon. They will already be bored, Andy, and open to negotiation.
He held up his hand and rubbed a thumb over his forefinger.
What is the usual rate?
For four people.
Do they need to know our package is people? Hudson asked in return.
Kovach shrugged.
No, I suppose not. Then some pairs of shoes. The Reeboks are very popular, you know, and some Western movie tapes. They already have all the tape player machines they need, Kovach explained.
Be generous, Hudson suggested, but not too generous.
Mustn't make them suspicious, he didn't have to add. If they are married, perhaps something for their wives and children.
I know Budai's family well, Andy. That will not be a problem.
Budai had a young daughter, and giving something for little Zoka would cause no problems for the smuggler.
Hudson made a calculation for distance. 2.5 hours to the Yugoslav border should be about right at that time of night. They'd be using a small truck for the first part of the journey. Istvan would handle the rest in his larger truck. And if anything went wrong, Istvan would expect to be shot by the British Secret Service officer. That was one benefit of the world-famous James Bond movies. But more to the point, 5,000 D-mark went a very long way in Hungary.
I will be driving to what destination?
I will tell you tonight, Hudson answered.
Very well. I shall meet you at Chorogo at 2 tomorrow morning, without fail.
That is very good, Istvan. Hudson finished his coffee and stood.
It is good to have such a reliable friend.
You pay me well, Kovach observed, defining their relationship. Hudson was tempted to say how much he trusted his agent, but that wasn't strictly true. Like most field spooks, he didn't trust anybody. Not until after the job was completed. Might Istvan be in the pay of the ABH?
Probably not.
No way they could afford 5,000 West German marks on anything approaching a regular basis. And Kovach liked the good life too much. If the communist government of this country ever fell, he'd be among the first to become a millionaire, with a nice house in the hills of Pest on the other side of the Danube, overlooking Buda. 20 minutes later, Hudson found Ryan at the front of the line in the embassy canteen.
Like your eggs, I see, the COS observed.
Local? Or do you truck it in from Austria?
The eggs are local. The farm products here are actually quite good. But we like our English bacon.
Developed a taste for it myself, Jack reported.
What's happening? He asked.
Andy's eyes had a certain excitement in them.
It's tonight. First we go to the concert hall, and then we make our pickup.
Giving him a heads up?
Hudson shook his head. No. He might act differently.
I prefer to avoid that complication.
What if he's not ready?
What if he has second thoughts? Jack worried.
In that case, it's a blown mission. And we disappear into the mists of Budapest. And come tomorrow morning, many faces will be red in London, Washington, and Moscow.
You're pretty cool about this, buddy.
In this job, you take things as they come. Getting excited about them doesn't help at all.
He managed to smile.
So long as I take the Queen's shilling and eat the Queen's biscuit, I shall do the Queen's work.
Semper Fi, man, Jack observed. He added cream to his coffee and took a sip. Not great, but good enough for the moment. So was the food in the state-run cafeteria next door to the Hotel Astoria. Svetlana had chosen and positively inhaled a cherry Danish pastry, along with a glass of whole milk.
The concert is tonight, Oleg told his wife. You excited?
You know how long it has been since I've been to a proper concert, she retorted.
Oleg, I shall never forget this kindness on your part.
She was surprised by the look on his face, but made no comment on it.
Well, my dear, today we have more shopping to do. Ladies' things. You will have to handle that for me.
Anything for myself?
To that end, we have 850 Comic-Con rubles, just for you to spend, Oleg Ivanich told her with a beaming smile, wondering if anything she bought would be in use by the end of the week.
Your husband still off on business? Beaverton asked.
Unfortunately, Kathy confirmed.
Too bad, the former para didn't say. He'd become a good student of human behavior over the years, and her unhappiness with the current situation was plain. Well, Sir John was doubtless off doing something interesting. He'd taken the time to do a little research on the Ryans. She, the papers said, was a surgeon, just as she'd told him weeks before. Her husband, on the other hand, despite his claim to be a junior official at the American Embassy, was probably CIA. It had been hinted at by the London papers back when he'd had that run-in with the ULS terrorists, but that supposition had never been repeated. Probably because someone had asked Fleet Street, politely, not to say such a thing ever again. That told Eddie Beaverton everything he needed to know. The papers had also said he was, if not rich, certainly comfortably set, and that was confirmed by the expensive Jaguar in their driveway. So, Sir John was away on secret business of some sort or other. There was no sense in wondering what, the cab driver thought, pulling up to the miniature Chatham train station.
Have a good day, Mum, he told her when she got out.
Thanks, Eddie. The usual tip. It was good to have such a generous, steady customer. For Kathy, it was the usual train ride into London with the company of a medical journal, but without the comfort of having her husband close by, reading his Daily Telegraph, or dozing. It was funny how you could miss even a sleeping man next to you.
That's the concert hall.
Like Ryan's old Volkswagen Rabbit, the Budapest concert hall was well made in every detail, but little, hardly filling the city block it sat upon, its architecture hinting at the imperial style found in better and larger form in Vienna, 200 miles away. Andy and Ryan went inside to collect the tickets arranged by the embassy through the Hungarian Foreign Ministry. The foyer was disappointingly small. Hudson asked for permission to see where the box was, and by virtue of his diplomatic status, an usher took them upstairs and down the side corridor to the box. Inside it struck Ryan as similar to a Broadway theater. The Majestic, for example, not large but elegant, with its red velvet seating and gilt plaster, a place for the king to come when he deigned to visit the subject city far from his imperial palace up the river in Vienna. A place for the local big shots to greet their king and pretend they were in the big leagues, when they and their sovereign knew differently. But, for all that, it was an earnest effort, and a good orchestra would cover for the shortcomings. The acoustics were probably excellent, and that was what really mattered. Ryan had never been to Carnegie Hall in New York, but this would be the local equivalent, just smaller and humbler, though grudgingly so. Ryan looked around. The box was admirably suited for that. You could scan just about every seat in the theater. Our friends' seats, where are they? He asked quietly.
Not sure. Tom will follow them in and see where they sit before he joins us.
Then what? Jack asked next.
But Hudson cut him off with a single word.
Later.
Back at the embassy, Tom Trent had his own work to do. First of all, he got 2 gallons of pure grain alcohol, 190 proof, or 95% pure. It was technically drinkable, but only for one who wanted a very fast and deep drunk. He sampled it, just to taste, to make sure it was what the label said. This was not a time to take chances. 1 millimetric taste was enough for that. This was as pure as alcohol ever got, with no discernible smell, and only enough taste to let you know that it wasn't distilled water. Trent had heard that some people used this stuff to spike the punch at weddings and other formal functions to liven things up a bit. Surely this would accomplish that task to a fairly well. The next part was rather more distasteful. It was time to inspect the boxes. The embassy basement was now off limits to everyone. Trent cut loose the sealing tape and lifted off the cardboard to reveal. The bodies were in translucent plastic bags, the sort with handles used by morticians to transport bodies. The bags even came in more than one size, he saw, probably to accommodate the bodies of children and adults of various dimensions. The first body he uncovered was that of a little girl. Blessedly, the plastic obscured the face, or what had once been a face. All he could really see was a blackened smudge, and for the moment, that was good. He didn't need to open the bag, and that, too, was good. The next boxes were heavier, but somehow easier. At least these bodies were adults. He manhandled them onto the concrete floor of the cellar and left them there, then moved the dry ice to the opposite corner, where the frozen CO2 would evaporate on its own without causing harm or distraction to anyone. The bodies would have about 14 hours to thaw out, and that, he hoped, would be enough. Trent left the basement, being careful to lock the door. Then he went to the embassy's security office. The British legation had its own security detail of 3 men, all of them former enlisted servicemen. He'd need 2 of them tonight. Both were former sergeants in the British Army, Rodney Truelove and Bob Small, and both were physically fit. "Lads, I need your help tonight with something."
"What's that, Tom?"
Truelove asked.
"We'll just need to move some objects and do it rather covertly," Trent semi-explained. He didn't bother telling them it would be something of great importance. These were men for whom everything was treated as a matter of some importance.
"Sneak in and sneak out?" Small asked.
"Correct," Trent confirmed to the former color sergeant in the Royal Engineers. Small was from the Royal Regiment of Wales, the men of Harlech.
"What time?" Truelove inquired next.
"We'll leave here about 0200. Ought not to take more than an hour overall."
"Dress?" This was Bob Small. And that was a good question. To wear coats and ties didn't feel right, but to wear coveralls would be something a casual observer might notice. They'd have to dress in such a way as to be invisible.
"Casual," Trent decided. "Jackets, but no coats. Like a local.
Shirts and pants. That should be sufficient.
Gloves, too."
"Yeah, they'll surely want to wear gloves," the spook thought.
"No problem with us," Truelove concluded.
As soldiers, they were accustomed to doing things that made no sense and taking life as it came. Trent hoped they'd feel that way the following morning.
Fogal pantyhose were French in origin. The packaging proclaimed that. Irina nearly fainted, holding the package in her hand.
The contents were real, but seemed not to be, so sheer as to be a manufactured shadow, and no more substantial than that. She'd heard about these things, but she'd never held them in her hand, much less worn any. And to think that any woman in the West could own as many as she needed. The wives of Oleg's Russian colleagues would swoon wearing them, and how envious her own friends at Gum would be, and how careful they'd be putting them on, afraid to create a run, careful not to blunder into things with their legs, like children who bruised every single day. These hose were far too precious to endanger. She had to get the right size for the women on Oleg's list, plus 6 pairs for herself. But what size? To buy any article of clothing that was too large was a deadly insult to a woman in any culture, even Russia, where women tended more to the Rubenesque than to a starving waif in the Third World. Or Hollywood. The sizes shown on the packages were A, B, C, and D. This was an additional complication, since in Cyrillic, B corresponded to the Roman V and C to S. But she took a deep breath and bought a total of 20 pairs of size C, including the 6 for herself. They were hideously expensive, but the Comic-Con rubles in her purse were not all hers. And so with another deep breath, she paid cash for the collection, to the smile of the female sales clerk, who could guess what was going on. Walking out of the store with such luxuries made her feel like a czarist princess, a good sensation for any female in the world. She now had 489 rubles left to spend on herself, and that almost produced a panic. So many nice things, so little money, so little closet space at home. Shoes? A new coat? A new handbag? She left out jewelry, since that was Oleg's job, but, like most men, he didn't know a thing about what women wore. What about foundation garments, Irina wondered next. A chanterelle brassiere? Did she dare purchase something that elegant? That was at least 100 rubles, even at this favorable exchange rate. And it would be something only she knew she had on. Such a brassiere would feel like hands. Like the hands of your lover. Yes, she had to get one of those. And cosmetics. She had to get cosmetics. It was the one thing Russian women always paid attention to. She was in the right city for that. Hungarian women cared about skin care as well. She'd go to a good store and ask, comrade to comrade. Hungarian women. Their faces proclaimed to the world that they cared about their skin. In this, the Hungarians were most kulturni. It took another 2 hours of utter bliss, so pleasant that she didn't even notice her husband and daughter waiting about. She was living every Soviet woman's dream, spending money in, well, if not the West, then the next best thing. And it was wonderful. She'd wear the chanterelle to the concert tonight, listen to Bach, and pretend she was in another time and another place, where everyone was kulturni, and it was a good thing to be a woman. It was a pity that no such place existed in the Soviet Union. Outside the succession of women's stores, Oleg just stood around and smoked his cigarettes like any other man in the world, intensely bored by the details of women's shopping. How they could enjoy the process of picking and comparing, never making a decision, just sucking in the ambience of being surrounded by things they couldn't wear and didn't really like.
They always took the dress and held it up to their necks and looked in a mirror and decided, yet, not this one. On and on, past the sunset and into the night, as though their very souls depended on it. Oleg had learned patience with his current life-threatening adventure, but one thing he'd never learned and never expected to learn was how to watch a woman shop without wishing to throttle her. Just standing there like a fucking beast of burden, holding the things she'd finally decided to purchase, then waiting while she decided to change her mind or not. Well, it couldn't last forever. They did have tickets to the concert that night. They had to go back to the hotel, try to get a sitter for Zaitchik, get dressed, and go to the concert hall. Even Irina would appreciate that. Probably, Oleg Ivanich thought bleakly, as though he didn't have enough to worry about. But his little girl wasn't concerned about a thing, Oleg saw. She ate her ice cream and looked around at this different place with its different sights. There was much to be said for a child's innocence. A pity one lost it. And why, then, did children try so hard to grow up and leave their innocence behind? Didn't they know how wonderful the world was for them alone? Didn't they know that, with understanding, the wonders of the world only became burdens? And pain. And doubts, Zaitsev thought. So many doubts. But no, Zaitchik didn't know that. And by the time she found out, it would be too late. Finally, Irina walked outside with a beaming smile such as she'd not had since delivering their daughter. Then she really surprised him. She came up to him for a hug and a kiss. "Oh, Oleg, you are so good to me." And another passionate kiss of a woman sated by shopping. Even better than one sated by sex, her husband suddenly thought. "Back to the hotel, my dear. We must dress for the concert." The easy part was the ride on the metro, then into the Astoria and up to room 307. Once there, they decided more or less by default to take Svetlana with them. Getting a sitter would have been an inconvenience. Oleg had thought about a female KGB officer from the Culture and Friendship House across the street, but neither he nor his wife felt comfortable with such arrangements, and so Zaitchik would just have to behave herself during the concert. His tickets were in the room. Orchestra row 6, seats A, B, and C, which put him right on the aisle, where he preferred to be. Svetlana would wear her new clothes this evening, which he hoped would make her happy. It usually did, and these were the best clothes she'd ever had. The bathroom was crowded in their room. Irina worked hard and long to get her face right. It was easier for her husband, and easier still for their daughter, for whom a wet washcloth across her grimacing face was enough. Then they all got dressed in their best clothing. Oleg buckled his little girl's shiny black shoes over the white tights to which she'd taken an immediate love. Then she put on the red coat with the black collar, and the little bunny was all ready for the adventures of the evening. They took the elevator down to the lobby and caught a cab outside. For Trent, it was a little awkward. Staking out the lobby ought to have been difficult, but the hotel staff seemed not to notice him. And so, when the package left, it was a simple matter of walking out to his car and following their cab to the concert hall, just a mile down the street. Once there, he found a parking place close by and walked quickly to the entrance. Drinks were being served there, and the Zaitsevs availed themselves of what looked like a tokai before heading in. Their little girl was as radiant as ever. Lovely child, Trent thought. He hoped she'd like life in the West. He watched them head into the theater to their seats,
and then he turned to go up the stairs to his box. Ryan and Hudson were already there, sitting on the old chairs with their velvet cushions.
"Andy, Jack," Trent said in greeting. "Sixth row, left side of center, just on the aisle."
Then the house lights started flickering. The curtain drew back, the meandering tones of musicians tuning their various instruments trailed off, and the conductor, Yosef Rozsa, appeared from stage right. The initial applause was little more than polite. It was his first concert in the series, and he was new to this audience. That struck Ryan as odd. He was a Hungarian, a graduate of their own Franz Liszt Academy. Why wasn't their greeting more enthusiastic? He was a tall and thin guy with black hair and the face of an aesthete. He bowed politely to the audience and turned back to the orchestra. His little baton stick, whatever it was called, Ryan didn't know, was there on the little stand, and when he lifted it, the room went dead still. And then his right arm shot out to the string section of the Hungarian State Railroad Orchestra No. 1. Ryan was not the student of music that his wife was, but Bach was Bach, and the concerto built in majesty almost from the first instant. Music, like poetry or painting, Jack told himself, was a means of communication, but he'd never quite figured out what composers were trying to say. It was easier with a John Williams movie score, where the music so perfectly accompanied the action, but Bach hadn't known about moving pictures, and so he must have been talking about things that his original audiences would have recognized. But Ryan wasn't one of those, and so he just had to appreciate the wonderful harmonies. It struck him that the piano wasn't right, and only when he looked did he see that it wasn't a piano at all, but rather an ancient harpsichord, played, it seemed, by an equally ancient virtuoso with flowing white hair and the elegant hands of a surgeon, Jack thought. Jack did know piano music. Their friend, Sissy Jackson, a solo player with the Washington Symphony, said Kathy was too mechanical in her playing, but Ryan only noted that she never missed a key. You could always tell. And to him, that was sufficient. This guy, he thought, watching his hands and catching the notes through the wonderful cacophony, didn't miss a single note, and every one, it seemed, was precisely as loud or soft as the concert required, and so precisely timed as to define perfection. The rest of the orchestra seemed about as well practiced as the Marine Corps silent drill team, everything as precise as a series of laser beams. The one thing Ryan couldn't tell was what the conductor was doing. Wasn't the concerto written down? Wasn't conducting just a matter of making sure beforehand that everybody knew his part and did it on time? He'd have to ask Kathy about it, and she'd roll her eyes and remark that he really was a Philistine. But Sissy Jackson said that Kathy was a mechanic on the keyboard, lacking in soul. So there, Lady Caroline. The string section was also superb, and Ryan wondered how the hell you ran a bow along a string and made the exact noise you wanted to. Probably because they do it for a living, he told himself, and he sat back to enjoy the music. It was only then that he watched Andy Hudson, whose eyes were on the package. He took the moment to look that way as well. The little girl was squirming, doing her best to be good, and maybe taking note of the music, but it couldn't be as good as a tape of The Wizard of Oz, and that couldn't be helped. Still and all, she was behaving well, the little bunny sitting between Ma and Pa Rabbit. Mama Rabbit was watching the concert with rapt attention. Papa Rabbit was being politely attentive. Maybe they should call ahead to London and get Irina a Walkman, Jack thought, along with some Christopher Hogwood tapes. Kathy seemed to like him a lot, along with Neville Marriner. In any case, after about 20 minutes they finished the minuetto, the orchestra went quiet, and when conductor Rozsa turned to face the audience, The concert hall went berserk with cheering and shouts of bravo. Jack didn't know what he'd done differently, but evidently the Hungarians did. Rozsa bowed deeply to the audience and waited for the noise to subside before turning back and commanding quiet again as he raised his little white stick to start Brandenburg number 2. This one started with a brass and strings, and Ryan found himself entranced by the individual musicians more than whatever the conductor had done with them. How long do you have to study to get that good, he wondered. Kathy played 2 or 3 times a week at home in Maryland. Their Chatham house wasn't big enough for a proper grand piano, rather to her disappointment. He'd offered to get an upright, but she'd declined, saying that it just wasn't the same. Sissy Jackson said that she played 3 hours or more every single day. But Sissy did it for a living, while Kathy had another and somewhat more immediate passion in her professional life. The second Brandenburg concerto was shorter than the first, ending in about 12 minutes, and the third followed at once. Bach must have loved the violins more than any other instrument, and the local string section was pretty good. In any other setting, Jack might have given himself over to the moment and just drunk in the music. But he did have something more important planned for this evening. Every few seconds, his eyes drifted left to see the rabbit family. Brandenburg number 3 ended roughly an hour after number 1 had begun. The house lights came on, and it was time for the intermission. Ryan watched Papa Rabbit and Mrs. Rabbit leave their seats. The reason was plain. The bunny needed a trip to the little girl's room, and probably Papa would avail himself of the local plumbing as well. Hudson saw that and leapt to his feet, back out of the box, into the private corridor, closely followed by Tom Trent, and down the steps to the lobby and into the men's room, while Ryan stayed in the box and tried to relax. The mission was now fully underway. Not 50 yards away, Oleg Ivanich was standing in the line to use the men's room. Hudson managed to get right behind him. The lobby was filled with the usual buzz of small talk. Some people went to the portable bar for more drinks. Others were puffing on cigarettes, while 20 men or so were waiting to relieve their bladders. The line moved fairly rapidly. Men are more efficient at this than women are, and soon they were in the tiled room. The urinals were as elegant as everything else, seemingly carved from Carrara marble for this noble purpose. Hudson stood like everyone else, hoping that his clothing did not mark him as a foreigner. Just inside the wooden glass door, he took a breath and, leaning forward, called on his Russian. "Good evening, Oleg Ivanovich," Hudson said quietly. "Do not turn around." "Who are you?" Zaitsev whispered back. "I am your travel agent. I understand you wish to take a little trip."
"Where might that be?"
"Oh, in a westerly direction. You are concerned for the safety of someone, are you not?"
"You are CIA?"
Zaitsev could not utter the acronym in anything but a hiss.
"I am in an unusual line of work," Hudson confirmed. "No sense confusing the chap at the moment."
"So, what will you do with me?"
"This night, you will sleep in another country, my friend," Hudson told him, adding, "along with your wife and your lovely little daughter."
Hudson watched his shoulders slump. With relief or fear, the British spook wondered.
"Probably both."
Zaitsev cleared his throat before whispering again.
"What must I do?"
"First, you must tell me that you wish to go forward with your plan." Only the briefest hesitation before,
"Da, we will proceed."
"In that case, just do your business in here." They were approaching the head of the line. "And then enjoy the rest of the concert, and return to your hotel. We shall speak again there at
1:30 or so. Can you do that? Just a curt nod and a gasping single syllable.
Duh.
Oleg Ivanich really needed to use the urinal now. Be at ease, my friend. All is planned. All will go well, Hudson said to him. The man would need assurance and confidence now. This had to be the most frightening moment of his life. There was no further reply. Zaitsev took the next 3 steps to the marble urinal, unzipped, and relieved himself in more than one way. He turned to leave without seeing Hudson's face. But Trent saw his as he stood there and sipped a glass of white wine. If he'd made any signal to a fellow KGB spook in the room, the British officer hadn't seen it. No rubbing the nose or adjusting his tie, no physical sign at all. He just walked back through the swinging door and back to his seat. Beatrix was looking better and better. The audience was back in its seats. Ryan was doing his best to look like just one more classical music fan. Then Hudson and Trent re-entered the box.
Well? Ryan rasped.
Bloody good music, isn't it? Hudson replied casually. This Rozier chap is first-rate. Amazing that a communist country can turn out anything better than a reprise of the Internationale.
Oh, after it's over, Hudson added, how about a drink with some new friends?
Jack let out a very long breath.
Yeah, Andy, I'd like that.
Son of a bitch, Ryan thought. It's really going to happen. He had lots of doubts, but they'd just subsided half a step or so. It wasn't really very much, but it was a damn sight better than it could have been. The second half of the concert started with more Bach, the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Instead of strings, this one was a celebration of brass, and the lead cornet here might have taught Louis Armstrong himself something about the higher notes. This was as much Bach as Ryan had ever heard at one time, and that old German composer had really had his shit wired, the former Marine thought, for the first time relaxing enough to enjoy it somewhat. Hungary was a country that respected its music, or so it seemed. If there was anything wrong with this orchestra, he didn't notice it, and the conductor looked as though he were in bed with the love of his life, so transfixed he was by the joy of the moment. Jack wondered idly if Hungarian women were any good at that. There was an earthy look to them, but not much smiling. Maybe that was the communist government. Russians were not known for smiling, either.
So, any news? Judge Moore asked. Mike Bostock handed over the brief dispatch from London. Basil says his COS Budapest is going to make his move tonight. Oh, you'll love this part. The rabbit is staying in a hotel right across the street from the KGB Residentura.
Moore's eyes flared a bit.
You have to be kidding.
Judge, do you think I'd say that for the fun of it?
When does Ritter get back?
Later today, flying back on Pan Am.
From what he sent to us from Seoul, everything went pretty well with the KCIA meetings.
He'll have a heart attack when he finds out about Beatrix, the DCI predicted.
It will get his eyes opened, the deputy DDO agreed.
Especially when he finds out that this Ryan boy is in on it.
On that, sir, you can bet the ranch, the cattle, and the big house.
Judge Moore had himself a good chuckle at that one.
Well, I guess the agency is bigger than any one individual, right?
So they tell me, sir.
When will we know?
I expect Basil will let us know when the plane takes off from Yugoslavia. It's going to be a long day for our new friends, though.
The next selection was Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze.
Ryan recognized it as the tune played in a Navy recruiting commercial. It was a gentle piece, very different from that which had preceded it. He wasn't sure if this evening's performance was a showcase for Johann Sebastian or for the conductor. In either case, it was pleasant enough, and the audience was wildly appreciative, noisier than for the concert selection. One more piece. Ryan had a program, but hadn't bothered looking at it, since it was printed in Magyar, and he couldn't read Martian any better than he could decipher the spoken form. The last selection was Pachelbel's Canon, a justly famous piece, one that had always struck Ryan like a movie of a pretty girl saying her prayers back in the 17th century, trying to concentrate on her devotions instead of thinking about the handsome boy down the lane from her farmhouse, and not quite succeeding. With the end, Josef Rosa turned to the audience, which leapt again to its feet and howled its approval for endless minutes. Yeah, Jack thought, the local boy had gone away, but he'd come home to make good, and the homeboys from the old days were glad to have him back. The conductor hardly smiled, as though exhausted from running the marathon. And he was sweating, Jack saw. Was conducting that hard? If you were that far into it, maybe it was. He and his Brit companions were standing and applauding as much as everyone else. No sense standing out. Before finally, the noise stopped. Roja waved to the orchestra, which caused the cheering to continue, and then to the concertmaster of the orchestra, the first fiddle. It seemed gracious of Roja, but probably the thing you had to do if you wanted the musicians to put out their best for you. And then at long last, it was time for the crowd to break up. "Enjoy the music, Sir John?" Hudson asked with a sly grin. "It beats what they play on the radio at home," Ryan observed. "Now what?" "Now we get a nice drink in a quiet place." Hudson nodded to Trent, who made his own way off and took Ryan in tow. The air was cool outside. Ryan immediately lit a cigarette, along with every other man in view and most of the women. Hungarians didn't plan to live all that long, or so it seemed. He felt as tied to Hudson as a child to his mother, but that wouldn't last too much longer. The street had mostly apartment-type buildings. In a western city it would have been condos, but those probably didn't exist here. Hudson waved for Ryan to follow, and they walked 2 blocks to a bar, ending up following about 30 people leaving the concert. Andy got a corner booth from which he could scan the room, and a waiter came with a couple glasses of wine. "So, we go?" Jack asked. Hudson nodded. "We go. I told him we'd be to the hotel about 1:30. "And then?" "And then we drive to the Yugoslav border." Ryan didn't ask further. He didn't have to. "The security to the south is trivial. Different the other way," Andy explained. "Near the Austrian border it's fairly serious, but Yugoslavia, remember, is a sister communist state. That's the local fiction in any case. I'm no longer sure what Yugoslavia is, politically speaking. The border guards on the Hungarian side do well for themselves. Many friendly arrangements with the smugglers. That is a growth industry, but the smart ones don't grow too much. Do that and the Belug Ministerium, their interior ministry, might take notice." "Better to avoid that," Hudson reminded him. "But if this is the back door into the Warsaw Pact, hell, KGB's gotta know, right?" Hudson completed the question. "So why don't they shut things down?" "I suppose they could, but the local economy would suffer. And the Sovs get a lot of the things they like here, too. Trent tells me that our friend has made some major purchases here. Tape machines and pantyhose.
bloody pantyhose, their women kill for the things. Probably most are overtly intended for friends and colleagues back in Moscow. So if KGB intervened or forced the AVH to do so, then they would lose a source of things they themselves want. So a little corruption doesn't do any major damage, and it supplies the greed of the other side. Never forget that they have their weaknesses, too. Probably more than we do, in fact, much as people argue to the contrary. They want the things we have. Official channels can't work very well, but the unofficial ones do. There's a saying in Hungarian that I like. A nagy kapu mellett, mindig van egy kis kapu. Next to the big gate, there is always a little door. That little door is what makes things work over here.
And I'm going through it.
Correct.
Andy finished his wine and decided against another. He had a ways to drive tonight, in the dark, over inferior roads. Instead, he lit one of his cigars. Ryan lit a smoke of his own.
I've never done this before, Andy.
Frightened?
Yeah, Jack admitted freely.
Yeah, I am.
First time is never easy.
I've never had people with machine guns come into my home.
I don't recommend it as after-dinner entertainment, Jack replied, with a twisted smile.
But we managed to luck our way out of it.
I don't really believe in luck.
Well, sometimes, perhaps.
Luck does not go about in search of a fool, Sir John.
Maybe so. Kinda hard to notice from the inside. Ryan thought back again to that dreadful night. The feel of the Uzi in his hands. Having to get that one shot right. No second chance in that ballgame. And he'd dropped to one knee, taken aim, and gotten it right. He'd never learned the name of the guy in the boat he'd stitched up.
Strange, he reflected.
If you kill a man right by your home, you should at least know his name. But yeah, if he could do that, he could damn well do this. He checked his watch. It would be a while still, and he wasn't driving tonight, and another glass of wine seemed a good idea. But he'd stop it there.
Back at the Astoria, the Zaitsevs got their little bunny to bed, and Oleg ordered some vodka to be brought up. It was the generic Russian vodka brand that the working class drank, a half-liter bottle with a foil closure at the top that essentially forced you to drink it all in one sitting. Not an altogether bad idea for this night. The bottle arrived in 5 minutes, and by then Zaitchik was asleep. He sat on the bed. His wife sat in the one upholstered chair. They drank from tumblers out of the bathroom. Oleg Ivanich had one task yet to perform. His wife didn't know his plan. He didn't know how she'd react to it. He knew she was unhappy. He knew that this trip was the high point of their marriage. He knew she hated her job at Gum, that she wanted to enjoy the finer things in life. But would she willingly leave her motherland behind? On the plus side of the ledger, Russian women did not enjoy much in the way of freedom, within their marriages or without. They usually did what their husbands told them to do. The husband might pay for it later, but only later. And she loved him and trusted him, and he'd shown her the best of good times in the past few days, and so, yes, she'd go along. But he'd wait before telling her. Why spoil things by taking a risk right now? Right across the street was the KGB's Budapest Residentura, and if they got word of what he had planned, then he was surely a dead man. Back at the British Embassy, Sergeants Bob Small and Rod Truelove lifted the plastic bags and carried them to the embassy's nondescript truck. The license tags had already been switched. Both tried to ignore the contents, then went back to get the alcohol containers,
plus a candle and a cardboard milk carton. Then they were ready. Neither had so much as a glass of beer that night, though both wished otherwise. They drove off just after midnight, planning to take their time to scout the objective before committing to a course of action. The hard part would be getting the right parking place, but with more than an hour to pick it, they were confident that one would appear in due course. The bar was emptying out, and Hudson didn't wish to be the last one in there. The bar bill was 50 forints, which he paid, not leaving a tip because it wasn't the local custom, and it wouldn't do to be remembered. He motioned to Ryan and headed out, but on second thought made his way to the loo. The thought struck Ryan as very practical, too. Outside, Ryan asked what came next. "We take a stroll up the street, Sir John," Hudson answered, using the knightly title as an unfair barb. 30 minutes stroll to the hotel, I think, will be about right." The exercise would also give them a chance to make sure they weren't being followed. If the opposition were on to their operation, they'd be unable to resist the temptation to shadow the two intelligence officers, and on mainly empty city streets it wouldn't be too difficult to make them along the way, unless the opposition consisted of KGB. They were cleverer than the locals by a sizable margin. Zaitsev and his wife had the comfortable glow of 3 very stiff drinks each. Oddly, his wife showed little sign of approaching sleep, however. Too excited by the night's fine entertainment, Oleg thought. Maybe it was for the better. Just that one more worry to go. Except for how the CIA planned to get them out of Hungary. What would it be? A helicopter near the border flying them under Hungarian radar coverage? That was what he would have chosen.